This is the record. I'm Ross Reynolds. It was more than 20 years ago that Nirvana released their third and final studio album, In Utero, and it's been more than 25 years since the group formed. But between the birth of that quintessential Northwest grunge band and their first charting single, there was a tour that changed it all. Nirvana was sent to Europe by their label Sub Pop. The idea was that if they could make it there, they could finally make it here. Bruce Pavitt is the co-founder of the music label Sub Pop. He's also the author and photographer behind the new book Experiencing Nirvana, Grunge in Europe, 1989. I spoke to him recently about what happened on the road and what was on the line for Sub Pop when Nirvana, Tad, and Mudhoney set out on a European tour.
On December 3rd, 1989, Sub Pop had our first international showcase, which was Lamefest UK in London, and was a coming together of our three best live acts, Tad, Nirvana, and Mudhoney. And they essentially won over the British press, which was the most influential music media in the world at the time. And from that point, I believe that the Seattle scene legitimately started to become an international phenomenon.
You allude to the fact that the British groups of the time had different, very different performing styles than the bands from Seattle.
Yes. At the time, what was in vogue was, quote unquote, the shoegazing bands. So it was fashionable to just not express yourself physically, but to be as less involved with the audience as possible. The Seattle groups were just the opposite. They're very physically expressive. A lot of them, all three of them actually, really deified Iggy Pop and the Stooges. I think that might be kind of the godfather of grunge, or the kind of rock and roll that the bands were playing. Anyhow, they put on very intense live shows, very expressive, and there was a lot of audience participation. And when you flip through the book, you'll see just how activated the British crowd was, and with all the stage diving and the crowd surfing, and the level of energy there was spectacular.
The photos are kinetic. I mean, they're just full of movement and unbelievable scenes going on, and an amazing audience reaction. What was on the line for these bands, and what was on the line for Sub Pop in launching this European tour in 89?
At that time, Sub Pop was a struggling indie label with few resources, but a good feel for hype and a good feel for spotting good live bands. By helping to organize these European tours, Mudhoney was touring by themselves, Tad and Nirvana were traveling together, they met up in London for this showcase. We felt that by organizing this particular showcase and igniting some international attention for the bands, we would then be able to get the attention of major media in the United States. Now, in the United States, the music media was very locked up. If you were an local indie band, it was very difficult to get coverage from Rolling Stone, for example, or MTV or any kind of mainstream music press. So by attaining the attention of the British press, we were able to legitimize ourselves in the eyes of the mainstream American press, music press.
Given what happened since 1989, it seems like, oh, this was obviously going to be the triumph it was. But I'm wondering, when you were on that tour and planning for that tour, whether you were as confident at the time that it would be the success that it became.
To be honest, Ross, I don't think anybody had any idea that Seattle was going to blow up quite as big as it did. But my partner, Jonathan Poneman, and I had a very deep belief that these were some of the greatest rock and roll bands in the world. And if only other people had a chance to witness this, that they'd be as swept up as we were. You have to realize John and I weren't bringing home large salaries at the time. I believe I had a $200 a month apartment on Capitol Hill. I was even struggling to pay my rent at that time. However, the rush and the excitement and the thrill of seeing these bands is what kept us going. We knew there was something special here, and we did everything we could to help generate interest in the scene.
I'm talking to Bruce Pavitt, and he's talking about experiencing Nirvana grunge in Europe, 1989, a micro history. It's a book of photography and also Bruce Pavitt writing about this kind of legendary tour now. And it's not as though it was with drama. It was with a fair amount of drama. You talk about a particular gig that happened in Rome that was quite tumultuous. What happened?
Absolutely. When John and I first arrived in Europe, we had heard that Kurt Cobain in particular was suffering from nervous exhaustion. So we landed in Rome hoping to revive Kurt's spirits and to help usher the bands up to the very crucial London showcase. The show we witnessed that night involved Kurt smashing his last guitar, climbing a rather large PA stack, threatening to jump. And after the security staff managed to talk him down, he then smashed the club's microphone and declared that the band was over. So Nirvana had essentially broken up at that moment. And the next day, John and I pulled Kurt aside. We spent a day in Rome just chilling out. Eventually, we caught up with the rest of the band in Geneva the next night. But I think taking Kurt out for a day and really doing our best to convince him that it was in his best interest to pull the band together and go on to the showcase was a crucial moment in the history of Nirvana.
I can't imagine what would be going through your mind witnessing this meltdown. I mean, the kind of worry about, oh my goodness, one of our key bands here, the lead singer, the star of it, just said he's breaking up the band.
Well, I have to say, when you experience something like that, I wasn't seeing it through the eyes of a business person like, oh my God, my record label's going to fall apart. I was viewing the situation from the perspective of a friend who was just really worried about my friend's mental state.
Well, Nirvana was not the biggest band in 1989 on this tour. Mudhoney was Sub Pop's flagship band. So how did Nirvana compare on stage with Mudhoney and Ted?
That's a good question, Ross. Mudhoney was definitely the flagship band at the time. In fact, when we approached the Astoria Theater in London, we looked at the marquee and the only band listed was Mudhoney. But I have to say, after Nirvana spent 6 weeks, night after night, touring Europe, I believe they had really fine-tuned their live show an excellent point. And I would say that they were the surprise act of the evening. They were the opener. But when you look at these photos, Kurt leaping up in the air, the audience members leaping off the stage, I think it will become apparent in viewing these photos that Nirvana kind of caught everybody's surprise and won over the British crowd.
What was it like to be at Lamefest UK?
It was a complete thrill to be at Lamefest UK. The 2,000-seat Astoria had essentially sold out. Now, I must point out that typically these indie rock shows would bring in 100 to 200 people. So to sell out a 2,000-person venue was a big deal at the time. There were writers from Sounds, Melody Maker, New Music Express, Steve Double. The Sounds photographer was there. He took some amazing shots, which are also included in the book. And it was a real sense of victory and accomplishment.
You wrote that you came home broke after this triumphant tour.
We did. Well, the punchline to that is that we went over there broke. So
no worse than
we went over there broke and we came home broke. But we came home richer in that the show was a success and ultimately the tour was a success. And once audiences witnessed any of these bands, they were won over. And that was the whole point, was to just blow people away. Our primary consideration at Sub Pop in signing any band at that time was, do they have a spectacular live show? Because they weren't going to get played on the radio. They weren't going to get written about in Rolling Stone. How are we going to sell these bands? Well, they had to deliver live. and we did everything we could to get them out there, not only in Europe, but in the States. And once people saw any one of these three groups, they were won over.
It sounds like the experience of the tour itself was a giant success, but did it take many months after that to realize that your whole strategy of breaking these bands to the British press had yielded the results you were looking for?
It was the constant experience of momentum, one foot after the other, and every month that we were in business, things got more exciting. More people were won over with the groups. And I must say that in Nirvana's case, however, in playing Lamefest UK, they were described as quote-unquote Sub Pop's answer to the Beatles. And when New Music Express, which would be the British equivalent to like Rolling Stone, for example, says something like that, you can best believe that there are a lot of executives at major labels, you know, opening up their checkbooks to see if they can indeed steal the band away from Sub Pop, which is essentially what happened.
It was a very interesting, it was great music that was coming up, as was proven even more decisively after this 1989 tour. But I wonder, looking back on it now, the strategy and the tactics that you took at Sub Pop were really interesting too. I mean, flying British writers over here to see the bands, taking the bands to Europe to kind of get that showcase. Do you think that kind of promotion and success, even with great bands, would work today in the changed media environment?
Well, it's such a different ballgame. Yeah. You know, this era was pre-internet. So access to information about bands was hard to find. You know, a young kid might have to go down to the Pike Place Market to get a copy of NME that was 6 weeks old and then dig for information there. It is a whole new ballgame, and I think working YouTube is probably the most successful strategy that young indie bands have right now. You can shoot a video for $50 and potentially get a million hits. So from a budget perspective, that might be a little more cost effective than going over to Europe. But at that time, I felt it was our best strategy.
How did you think about the records themselves? Because I've always thought that it was kind of brilliant to do some of the things that you did. You obviously were thinking of the Sub Pop 100 and the Singles Club as kind of a novel strategy at the time. Could you talk about how that developed?
Sure. Our primary initial market when we first started the business was to cater to record collectors. And one of the things we did is we pressed records in different colored vinyls, and we would limit their pressing, which was counterintuitive for some people. It's like, what? Nirvana's first single, you only pressed 1,000 copies? Well, yes, but we hand-numbered them. And in order to get them, you had to join our singles club. It was a very effective promotion strategy because by reducing the supply, we increased the demand and triggered more excitement and more hype for the label.
Of course, today, everyone in Seattle is so proud of what Nirvana did and what Sub Pop has done. But back in 1989, was it hard? How hard was it to get press, local press, about your bands?
Well, I'll tell you, there was an epic moment in June of 1989. Sub Pop outrageously decided to rent the Moore Theater and have these same three bands perform. And that was the first Lamefest showcase, Nirvana, Tad, and Mudhoney. And I'll tell you, the manager came out early in the evening and he said, well, I've sent most of my security home because there's not going to be anybody here tonight because we've never sold out a local show. Well, it did sell out. Kids went crazy. There wasn't enough security. And the Moore essentially didn't invite us back for at least 10 years because there was so much chaos. Once I witnessed that level of excitement at the show, both John and I knew that we had to get those same three bands over to England.
Did the local press get it?
It was reviewed. I will say that it was reviewed by the Times. I don't think very favorably, But I was there. I saw the reaction of the kids there, and I knew that we had kind of a winning formula, despite what the Seattle Times had to say.
Bruce Pavitt, you and your partner and co-founder at Sub Pop, Jonathan Poneman, really have an interesting complementary relationship, it sounds like. I wonder if you could describe that.
Yes. Well, John and I got together in 88 to turn what was essentially my hobby into a career option for both of us. We actually rented an office space downtown. And interestingly enough, we're very different personalities. And it's, I would say that he was more of the left brain and I was more of the right brain. So it was very complimentary. I was much more visually oriented. He was all about business strategy and logic. But ultimately, we were both hardcore music fans. We loved pop history. We loved underground music. He had the local music show Audio Oasis over on KCMU, which is now KEXP. And I had my own specialty show, Sub Pop USA, that showcased indie music from around the country. So it was our love and passion for regional music that really brought us together.
You were in college at Evergreen, and Sub Pop started as a radio show at Chaos in Olympia, and it famously had a reputation for playing indie music and not playing music from record labels. It was a matter of policy there. In this day and age, does that kind of indie major label division make sense now that every band that wants to can kind of distribute its music or get it out through the internet? Do we still see that division?
Well, it's less defined than it used to be back in 79 when I was working at Chaos. However, I would have to say ultimately it's really about spirit and creativity. The acts that generally tended to release their own material on their own record labels or that worked together in concert with other local bands on a local label, I would have to say those personalities tended to be, by nature, nonconformists. Okay, pioneers, critical thinkers. And those bands that moved to LA to get signed to a major label, I would characterize as just the opposite. So ultimately, I think, you know, when you look at a social group, you kind of see the guys who were people who were working the fringes and those that are going towards the center, and that will always be the case. So I celebrate the freaks, the outsiders. I raise my glass to all you freaks out there.
Bruce Pavitt, you've been living on Orcas Island and recently relocated back here to Seattle. Will you be taking a more active role with Sub Pop now that you're here again?
Not really. I'm on the board of advisors and I go down and kind of hang out with the crew a bit. But right now I'm focused on family. I've got a second book project coming out, which is a collection of my early writings, my Subterranean Pop zines and rocket columns from the 80s. It's going to feature over 1,000 indie reviews from the 80s and so forth. I also really enjoy DJing. So my goal in life right now is to become the world's best party DJ. So if you've got a wedding or a bar mitzvah, give me a call.
Are you doing any club dates?
I have been doing some club dates. I just recently did one at Rebar, playing a lot of vintage dub and reggae. I'm a musical omnivore, so really I can spin just about anything. But playing music for people in a live situation is really my favorite thing to do.